The Andante from the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. More on that later, because our reason for being here is that is a selection of our guest, and we're going now into our second program of discussion with him, Walter E. Massey, M-A-S-S-E-Y, president of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, but also a physicist, also a former president of Morehouse College and a former director of the National Science Foundation, Argonne National Laboratory, and former chairman of Bank of America. We're going to have to get into a lot and try to get all of that and more music into our second hour here. Walter Massey, welcome back, and thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
When we left off last week, you were talking about a point in your life where you were doing physics, as they say, but you were also becoming concerned about and interested in the issue of science education, how physics was taught, and how more minority students might come into physics and math, other sciences, and how they might stay in those fields and succeed in them. Tell us a bit about that period of your moving into or adding on those areas of science education.
When I came to Argonne, it was 1966, and it was really the height of this, maybe not the height, but it was the civil rights movement was in full blossom, and it spread to northern cities. There had been riots in several cities, and many of the major white, predominantly white universities were now aggressively recruiting black students, African-American students then. And I was offered a position at University of Illinois at Urbana. I had been at Argonne. It was my first teaching position. And two reasons I accepted it. One, at that time, Urbana, we call it Urbana, was the absolutely best theoretical physics group in the world for the field I was in. John Bardeen, two-time Nobel Prize winner, was one of the leaders of the group. Leo Kadanoff, Gordon Bain, physicists will know the names.
And this was people who were working with superfluids and
they were working
temperature
with
physics,
quantum fluids, many-body physics, we called it. Any physics has to do with the theory of systems that are composed of many particles, which is practically everything. Solid-state physics, condensed matter physics are the names that are used. But also the primary reason was that I felt I was at Argonne, I was doing physics, but I felt I was really not engaged in the real issues of the day, not being on a college campus. And so this gave me an opportunity to be on a campus where there were a lot of students, black students being recruited, and I felt I would be engaged. And I was at Urbana. It was I stayed there a year and a half. It was a year, a very, very full year. But one of the things I discovered, I taught an introductory physics course. We had a number of students from schools in Chicago and Philadelphia in particular, black students, and they were just not prepared. They were smart, they were bright, they were hardworking, but it was clear that their high school education was not adequate. So that's when I got interested in high school science education, so I began to investigate there. And that led me to believing that if I could make a contribution by maybe concentrating on how to improve the quality of science teaching in inner city schools. And I went to Brown, and that's where I started this program called the Inner City Teachers of Science.
What did you find at that time? What did you find, what did you think was required to move these questions and issues forward?
Some of the same things we speak about now, and I spent a lot of my career involved in these issues. One was that the teachers themselves were not adequately prepared in science, so they simply couldn't teach it at the level it should have been taught. And for urban schools, that many of the teachers, and a number of them had no experience in inner cities, many of them were white, didn't really appreciate the culture of urban schools, and so they were sort of double handicapped. So the sort of theory behind our program at Brown was first to give the prospective teachers a rigorous foundation in the sciences, and secondly was to have them begin to go and teach or mentor or be in the schools from year one, whereas traditionally students who were studying teaching would only go into schools in their junior year for a semester of practice teaching. So there were many other things surrounding it, but those were the two things we tried to address.
Now, this could be not only an entire program, it could be a series of programs, but I'm curious for this initial set of conversations we're having, jumping ahead now 45, almost 50 years from when you were doing that work initially. We have so many additional problems with education now that maybe we, by the time we solve them, we won't be able to come back to fine-tuning science and so on. But where do you see this situation today in terms of urban education, in terms of recruiting and maintaining, retaining minority students in the hard sciences?
We've made a lot of progress. There are more PhDs in the sciences. When I received my PhD, I knew every black physicist in the country. We all knew each other.
Right.
We were maybe less than 20. So there's certainly the numbers have
So when you got your PhD, yeah, there were fewer than 20 black physics PhDs,
right,
in the country.
Right, yeah, exactly. And a large number of them were at Howard.
Right, right.
The historically, yeah, black colleges.
Right.
So we've made improvements, but I think unfortunately some of the core issues still remain. The quality of, especially in the sciences and math, STEM fields they call them now, the quality of education for the teachers is still not what it needs to be. And although I'm not an expert on the cultural issues on that side of it, I think there are still issues on that side of having teachers who understand the communities, you know, at a deep level in which they are engaged in teaching. So we've made progress, but some of the core issues are still there.
Right. Mm-hmm. You also went on to administrative positions then that were away from campuses and away from the classroom again, because you went back to Argonne. And you then also appointed by the first President Bush were director of the National Science Foundation. You also had interests in the issues of running these places as well as an interest in what they were doing. And you looked at ways technologies can be shared amongst institutions. You looked at ways universities and institutes ran themselves in handling research and making it, what's the word, not saleable, but usable, I guess.
Yes.
And so you've seemed always to combine an interest in doing things and thinking about how they're done. Is that a fair way of framing it?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but
okay.
I think that's true.
Try to get one of those an hour, so I feel good.
No, you have. I think that's true. And what led me into science administration, which was Argonne, because I had been dean of the college at Brown. And I, at that time, had intended to go back to research, mm-hmm, full-time teaching, whatever that might mean. But when I was offered the position at Argonne, it was just too good to turn down.
Sure.
It was a major national laboratory. And on top of that, it's run by the University of Chicago. You know, and we could move, my wife and I, we were in Providence at Brown, moving back to Hyde Park.
Right,
I mean,
okay.
it was combined too many
music
things.
Music to my ears.
That's right.
Yes.
And we did. We,
yeah,
moved to Hyde,
yeah,
Park. Where we
now,
still,
some would say you went from one school that had no requirements for college students to a school that had a Common Core curriculum for college students. So maybe you were going back to the true religion. I don't know.
it's interesting. I've talked about that on a number of occasions.
Have you? Yeah.
Yes, when people ask about liberal education and what it means in the liberal arts, and that being at an institution is almost polar opposites, but both very, very fine institutions.
Exactly. I mean, in a way, they show you there isn't a single answer.
Exactly.
Because if they were just two schools with different philosophies, but these are schools that produce some of the top and most interesting students and graduates in the country. Right?
That's true. Yeah. That's really true. And so Argonne, I learned a lot there, but what made that interesting then, I had to learn a lot about administering a big operation like that. And I had colleagues. I had a great mentor in Hannah Gray.
Mm-hmm.
Hannah recruited me, who was president of the University of Chicago at that time, to come back to be director of Argonne.
Now, today it's seen as almost uncouth to mention these things, but Mrs. Gray, of course, was the first woman president of a major private university of that size, and you must have been one of the first, if not the first, black heads of a major national laboratory.
Both are true statements.
Okay. So in some ways, there were other unspoken things that you both knew about the world and about each other's position in it. I'm taking that smile as to mean, were you listening in on our conversation?
No. Those issues, if you know Hannah Gray, you know those issues never came up.
That's right. That's why I said unspoken.
That's right. The merit of the situation, the fit for it. And I had some trying times at Argonne. We went through some difficult periods. I was announced, my appointment, I think, was announced. I believe it was April, but I was at Brown. There was big news at Brown because I was very popular, mm-hmm. dean, and I was very much involved in helping to implement what was called the new curriculum, now the Brown curriculum,
mm-hmm.
a few grades and majors. And
Pass-fail.
So mm-hmm. I wasn't seen as a person who might go to be directing what was then seen as a nuclear laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 weeks after the announcement of my appointment, we had the Three Mile Island incident,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, the whole nuclear reactor industry and the concept and viability of nuclear power began to, if not come under attack, be more scrutinized. And Argonne was the premier laboratory in that area. And our scientists and engineers were very involved after the Three Mile Island incident and trying to help clean it up, advise on safety and going forward and so forth. So I was really got right involved in this major national issue having
sure.
to do with nuclear energy.
We jump forward now. Walter, you have done so many things that there's no way to get them even into 2 hours. But I guess I want to get into some of the general questions of your experience returning to and running Morehouse College, your alma mater. And then, of course, we want to talk about how it was you came back to Chicago and to the School of the Art Institute and what you're doing there at a time when other people might be saying, don't you want to be sitting on a beach or don't you want to be looking back on all of your accomplishments? And instead, you're facing new challenges, I'm sure fascinating ones on a daily basis. But going back to Morehouse at a time after integration, after just a change in the whole national higher education landscape in terms of men and women, in terms of minorities, in terms of foreign students, in terms of many questions about finances, did you feel as if you were on a whole new planet, or you had returned to an old planet in a new universe, or I'm sure there are better analogies than those.
It wasn't as big a transition as I thought it might be. I pondered some of the questions you implied there, because at the time I was being recruited to come back, I was provost of the University of California for the system.
Oh, yes, right. We left out that small.
Yeah, that's why I went after the National Science Foundation.
Right.
And so, if you notice it, we've talked all of my career since I left Morehouse had been in major national research universities.
Right.
And that's where I saw my ending my career. That was the natural trajectory. So I wondered what it would be like going not just back to Morehouse, but to any small liberal arts college. But then going back to a historically black college, going back south. My wife had never lived in the south.
So we talked about
all of this, but because of what I owed Morehouse and with my respect for it, and it was like giving back to me to go back. I don't mean it was altruistic, you know. But that was one of the lures. But it actually turned out to be not that much of a transition.
I see.
We had the quality of the faculty at Morehouse was, you know, on par with the quality of the faculty at many of the other institutions at which I'd been over those years. And Morehouse was a national, well-respected institution. It was not a research institution. And because of the reputation of the college, I found myself still being able to be engaged in national policy issues.
Right.
So I was asked to chair the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board and to be on the President, Second Bush's Council of Science and Technology Advisors. So it was interesting. I had in my mind sort of said, well, I'd probably give up those things. But the most fulfilling aspect of being back at Morehouse was being on the campus with students.
Right.
Because I had gradually moved away in administrative jobs, and even at the University of California, the office of the provost of the system and president was not on a campus.
Right. So where was it?
It still is. It's in Oakland.
Okay. But there isn't a campus there. There's UC
Berkeley.
But it's still not there, and it's also almost an administrative position to the nth degree as opposed to a college campus experience.
It's like a holding company, right?
Most of the time,
I dealt with the governor, the legislature, to try to secure funding. And I had to spend time visiting all the campuses. And also I was responsible for three national laboratories, which was that was wonderful because that took me back to my laboratory world, Los Alamos and Livermore and Lawrence Berkeley. But I would visit the camp, UCLA, the chancellor sort of reported to the president, but, you know, I was delegated to work with them, be his, oversee them. Chancellor of UCLA had a football team, alumni, students.
Right.
Chancellor of Berkeley had all that. I was provost, nominally their superior. Yeah. I had none of those things.
So it was good to get back to real people, at least real campus people.
It was wonderful. Wonderful.
When you left Morehouse, and we're really going to have to do, I think, another program just about the National Science Foundation, but was it your intention to retire?
Yes.
I mean, retire not just from that job, but to retire. Yeah.
It was my intention to retire. Yeah. And to move back to Chicago, which was really not understood by our southern friends, the northern friends. Why would anybody retire to Chicago? So it was our intention to retire, and we moved back into the same building that we had lived in when we came in 1979. And when that year I retired, that's when I was elected chairman of Bank of America, and this was sort of the height of the financial crisis. So that became a full-time job for a year.
Hold on just a moment there, because I think your next music choice fits right in here.
The name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, this guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
I picked him Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But look at epitaph, he went to buy a half, according to this here and that telegraph.
For Paul Revere, I'll bite, I hear his foot's all right. Of course, it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But just a minute, boys, I got some beatbox noise. It says the great grandfather was equipoise.
I tell you, Paul Revere, now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I know it's Valentine, the morning works look fine. You know the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
So make an epitaph, he wins it by a half, according to this here and that telegraph. Epitaph,
Valentine, I got the horse.
Stubby K, Johnny Silver, and Douglas Dean in that little piece of perfection by Frank Lesser that opens Guys and Dolls, the, well, maybe one of the perfect musicals ever. Now, I want to make it clear that Walter Massey did pick that as one of the pieces of music he wanted to play, and we were talking about the economy and the mess it's been in and his work at Bank of America, but he did not pick this to match that. I just took the fact that we'd reached that point and so thought we'd play it then. Before you explain what your work was there, though, did you say you were in a production of Guys and Dolls?
I was.
Yeah.
When I was at Argonne in the 60s as a postdoc, it was something called the Hyde Park Music Theater.
Uh-huh.
In Hyde Park, and yeah, was started by a physicist at Argonne and his wife, and several of us who lived in Hyde Park ran it. My best friend, who has a PhD in chemistry, in fact, Ron Kirkland, was in it, and he recruited me to join, and we did Guys and Dolls.
And right? Who did you play?
I was in the chorus.
You were in the chorus.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. I was always a spear carrier. He was, my good friend, was a star in those shows.
So. All right. Well, it's good to have a variety of experiences, right, though, right? So you were recruited to come into Bank of America at the time when everything had just been shaking and falling and crumbling. I don't mean any one particular bank, but throughout the industry. And were you surprised when the first feelers came to you about this? Or?
Well, it wasn't like that. Okay. I had been on the board.
Right.
I had been on the board for almost over 15 years.
Okay.
I was on the board of the Bank of America in California, and then we merged with Nation Bank, and Charlotte became Bank of America. So I had been on the board, and what happened is, like most big corporations, there was a combined position of chairman and CEO. Ken Lewis had both positions. And that year, the shareholders voted and recommended that the bank split the positions. And that has become something that a lot of companies started to do then. So that in their minds, there would be more loci of responsibilities. And the board asked me to be chairman. So that's how I came to be chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you get much sleep that year?
No. No, I did not. It was supposed to be a part-time position that should have taken it's called non-executive chair, which means you don't manage the bank. You manage the board, and you deal with external relations, the regulators, government, shareholders, and the like. And that's what I thought. And I said, oh, it's a wonderful honor. And it became almost a full-time job for that year.
Now, you did say last week that your first academic love was arithmetic, so that had brought you into math and science. So, and then, of course, in the meantime, you had picked up extensive, unique experience in administration, so you got to put them together, your childhood love and your administrative capabilities.
I did. So I was... But to answer your question, did it come as a surprise? It came as a shock.
Okay.
It really did. I didn't expect, because I'm not a banker, and we had bankers on the board. We had other CEOs on the board, So I had expected some of my colleagues to be chosen. So it was quite an honor, and I was very nervous about the whole thing, but I couldn't say no to that.
Right.
But then, and within a week or so, I began to, none of us predicted what would have happened
right.
at that time. But it did bring together a lot of previous experiences. And I had been on bank boards a long time. One of the first boards I was on was the First National Bank of Chicago
right.
board here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, from a board perspective, I was experienced.
Right, sure, mm-hmm. sure. Then that year comes to an end, and what happens at that point?
We were going to retire.
But
this time we were going to retire.
We come to our next musical selection.
Another rope ding, another show in Philly, Boston, or Baltimore. A chance for stage folks to say hello. Another opening of another show. Another job that you hoped at last will make your future forget your past. Another pain where the ulcers grow. Another opening of another show. 4 weeks you rehearse and rehearse. 3 weeks and it couldn't be worse. 1 week will it ever be right? Then out of the hat is that big first night. The overture is about to start. You cross your fingers and hold your heart. It's curtain time and away we go. Another opening of another show.
Another opening, another show. In Philly, Boston, or Baltimore. A chance for stage folks to say hello. Another opening of another show. Another job that you hope at last will make your future forget your past. Another pain where the ulcers grow. Another opening of another show. 4 weeks you'll rehearse and rehearse. 3 weeks and it couldn't be worse. But it will never be right. Then out of the hat is that big first night. The overture is about to start. You cross your fingers and hold your heart. It's turn from time and away we go. Another opening.
Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate, another opening, another show. And that's what you experienced, Walter Massey. You were going to retire, but there was another opening, another show.
I didn't. When I picked the song because that was another play I was in with Hyde Park Music Theater.
Okay.
Not because of this, but you're right. That's right. Oh, my goodness.
You're psychic about your own life.
Right.
So how did it come then that you... went to the Art Institute?
I found in my life a number of things have come sort of serendipitously, like being chosen, asked to be chairman of the bank, things I was not thinking about doing. And the same thing here. The school, the president of the school at that time had left, and the board didn't want to have a search for a new president. They had just brought in a new provost, and they were in the middle of strategic planning, and some of the board members approached me and asked would I be willing to come on an interim basis to stay for a year or so to sort of help the new provost mentor her in the job. She's an experienced person, but I'm older, so we called it that. And to make sure, you know, things just went along smoothly.
Right.
And they knew I was not an artist. And that was all seemed to be okay because what they wanted me to do mainly was in the administrative part of the oversight of an institution. And it, although it's a school of art and design, it's still a college.
Right.
So it has many of the same issues, concerns, and challenges that other colleges have. So it sounded okay. And I met with some of the faculty members and administrators there, and they seemed very welcoming. And I said, okay, we'll talk to my wife, of course. And the board chair, Carrie McMillan, said, you don't even have to move. But after a year, I began to like it, and the faculty liked me. And they said, well, stay on another year. So I said, okay. And then after that, I was approached by some of the faculty to consider staying on, and I really thought about it seriously. I talked to a lot of the faculty leadership and administrators and boards, and we all just, and I love it.
Yeah.
And they accepted me, so
I mean, so often you have a situation where there's a board that thinks one thing and a faculty that thinks something very differently and a president caught in the middle or whatever. And in this case, everybody was pleased with you. You were pleased with them. And rather than get into search firms and people who come and go and have to start from scratch, you were there and everybody seems happy.
I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I think everybody is. It really has been a wonderful opportunity for me, and I'm loving it.
Tell us a bit about the school today and what you see as the issues in arts education, college and graduate arts education today.
A little about the school, because sure. I find that even in Chicago, people who know it don't really know it. As I said, it is a college. We have about 3,200 students, about 2,500 undergraduate, about 700 graduate students. We have students from all over the world. About 20% of them are international, from 55 different countries. And we have all the traditional disciplines, categories of art and design, painting, drawing, ceramics, sculpture, printmaking, and the like. But we also have, we were the first school in the country to have an art and technology department. We have visual communications, which is sort of graphic illustration. We have a School of Architecture graduate program, which was accredited a couple of years ago now, only one of four in the area, accredited schools of architecture. Our graduate programs are ranked, MFA programs are ranked second in the country after Yale, which is what most people don't realize. So it's a wonderfully prestigious institution and a wonderful student body. And we have a big impact in Chicago, probably also is not recognized. Our faculty work in communities. They work very closely in with the Chicago public school system and other schools and art education. And we started an initiative last year called the Chicago Initiative to, in fact, increase our engagement in the city. And we've increased our efforts to recruit more local students, and especially from the public schools. So we have a broad spectrum of engagement with the city and a broad spectrum of engagements nationally and worldwide.
I think a lot of people don't realize that the school is older than the museum. I think it goes back to the 1870s.
It started in 18—we'll have our 150th anniversary next year.
Okay.
I mean, not next year, in 2016.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the museum itself grows out of the school, and the two are parallel. I guess people used to say sister institutions. Now we say parallel or sibling or something. And also, of course, the impact that the school has on two areas, in addition to what you were talking about, I think, that the school has on the city. One, it has always been a magnet for young people to come here and for artists to stay here. And when you have the Art Institute and several other art schools now that have gained prominence, you've always got that youthful aspect to the art scene and to the making scene. People associate that with theater, but of course it happens with visual art and with the music students. And now that you all are also such property holders in the center of the city, and I know there's been some refinement of getting rid of excess property and the like, but with students studying and working in the Loop and on Michigan Avenue, that really opened up the whole area for this renaissance of residential use of downtown. I think I just heard somebody saying, an economist the other day, that there's the city as a whole is, of course, down in jobs, maybe 200,000 or something, but we have 35,000 new residents in the core area of the city, which creates all kinds of other opportunities. And I think the Art Institute, the school, has really paved the way for all of that.
Oh, that's true. My predecessor, once removed, Tony Jones, really was responsible for building the dormitories downtown.
Right.
So most people don't know that. We have two dormitories on State Street.
Right.
So students live there. And the students come and they stay.
Right.
And many of them stay in Chicago from all over the world. They start galleries. They go out in the community. They live downtown. But after the dorm, they go out into other communities. They live in Pilsen. They live in Hyde Park. They live up north. And you have these young creative people who are really, you know, spurring a revitalization in these areas.
Right.
Because they're creative people. They're very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that until I went to the school and got to know them and the artistic community. They go out after school and they may not find a traditional job. They will create a job. They will start a gallery.
So it starts by necessity, but then that entrepreneurial aspect fits in with what they're doing in the studio and what their education has been about.
Exactly.
Let's listen to another piece of music that nicely ties into this, and then that will also ask a question that allows us to wrap up our conversation.
Since then, gee, but it's nice to see you again. What's new? Probably I'm boring you. But seeing you is grand, and you were sweet to offer your hand. I understand, I do. Pardon my asking, what's new? Of course, you couldn't know that I haven't changed. I still love you so. Thank you. seeing you is grand, and you were sweet to offer your hand. I understand, adieu. Pardon my asking what's new. Of course, you couldn't know that I haven't changed. I still love you so.
Karen Allison, KarrinAllison. You hear her name, but you don't always know how to spell it. Karen Allison from the Ballads album, Remembering John Coltrane, taking many of his takes on ballads. And there we had the Robert Haggard and Johnny Burke standard, late standard, What's New. You might also know, or you might find it interesting if you don't know, that Karen Allison is the lady friend of Bill McLaughlin of Exploring Music, who is her gentleman friend. And that's been a couple for many years, and it brings both of them to Chicago from New York frequently, which is a wonderful thing. And Karen Allison's What's New was a choice of our guest today, Walter Massey, who has been telling us about his fascinating, unique, an overused word and a wrongly used word, neither overused nor incorrectly used in this case, a unique career, an American story of science and South and North and education and curiosity. And as I only guessed, I spoke to his public relations people at the School of the Art Institute, and I said, I'd love to have Walter Massey on the program, and I'd like him to bring some music. And I just guessed he was going to have, I will confess, though, in addition to seeing you and your wife at concerts and the like, I have had the privilege of attending balls and galas and so on. And when the Masseys hit the dance floor, you know you are in the presence of musical people, because I think you, people will say, now, that couple, are they professional dancers? And I say, well, they're experienced dancers, but they are elegant. Tell us a little bit about your wife, and then tell us what's new at the School of the Art Institute, and then we'll wrap
up. My wife's from Chicago. We met here on a blind date. Mm-hmm. I mentioned my good friend, who's a chemist, who mm-hmm. got me into the plays. Avon Kirkland, he introduced us. We were married on the University of Chicago's campus in Bond Chapel, right. You might say, of course. And we've been got married in 1969.
Yeah,
she's wonderful.
Yeah.
When I was doing physics, we had two young children, and she had been working, but she then stayed at home. But after I went into administration, we really became a team.
Yeah.
Because being an administrator involves a lot of working with external audiences, and being a college president involves a great deal of work with potential donors, hopefully donors, alumni and the faculty and the like. And I mean, Shirley's just fantastic at that. I mean, so a lot of my success in these jobs has been because that we have been a team at that,
right.
And they love it at the school.
Well, that's wonderful as well. I want to tell a tale a little bit out of school, if it's a problem, we'll chop it out. But we were chatting some years ago, a year after Don Randall had retired as president of the University of Chicago to become president of the Mellon Foundation. And you served on that board as well for a period, I think.
That's correct. Yes, I did.
He came back to town because a year afterwards his portrait was being unveiled. And there was a dinner, and We were all privileged to be invited because the Randalls got to choose the guest list, I guess. And a bunch of people were standing around the cocktail hour, and one gentleman was saying, not in a pretentious way, well, when my father went to the university, another faculty member said, well, yes, my grandfather taught here for a while and went through, and then you were sort of quiet holding your drink, and then you said, it's all very interesting, but I'm pretty certain I'm the only person here whose father-in-law was a janitor on this campus. And everybody got very quiet.
Wow, you remember that? He was the first black janitor at the University of Chicago. Yeah. He was at the lab school for all of his career. And when he died, he was the longest retired employee of the University of Chicago. You know, he had been retired
right.
longer. And in fact, Hugo Sonnenschein's wife, when he was president, did a wonderful thing. I mentioned that to her, and she said, we have to do something. And so the university, about 2 years before he died, they gave him an award.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And also a reminder that people, their lives, their accomplishments, they go on sometimes away from or under other people's radars.
Yeah.
And you don't know when a kid from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, is going to become president of the National Science Foundation, director of the National Science Foundation, or when a physicist is going to become the head of the nation's leading art school.
That's true. That's true.
So I felt that was a good way to maybe. So quickly, what are some of the challenges? What are some of the new things at the school?
The new things, I think, is that art and design education is really being recognized now outside of the traditional areas by people in the various industries and commerce as a place where bright, creative people are produced or educated.
Right.
And I think artists and designers is finding more opportunities to display their talent and to contribute. So that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. The challenges we have is like most private schools, is we have many more talented young people who we would like to have come, but who don't have the financial resources, and many of them reside in Chicago. So one of the things we have been working on is to try to generate more funds to provide scholarships. And what I think is a great story, one of our board members generously gave a gift last year to create a scholarship, and Shirley, my wife Shirley, in our name, the Walter and Shirley Massey Fund, specifically for high school, for students from Chicago who are talented but who don't have the financial resources. And we had our first class of five Massey Scholars this year.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
And we're going to continue to raise money for them.
And yeah. Rolling back, too, to your reminding us that you were a beneficiary of a scholarship that allowed you to go to Morehouse College back in the early 1950s, mid-1950s.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that sense of, as you said, it's not purely charity or altruism, but it's a giving back. It's a cycle that we're all a part of.
That's true. And that's another thing Benjamin Mays always stressed at Morehouse, you know, giving back to the community, the obligation one has to do that.
Well, I hope that you have enjoyed even half as much as I have getting to know Walter Massey better. That's Massey, president of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, a distinguished physicist, PhD from Washington University in St. Louis. And he's been the head of so many things that just to read them all would take us into another hour. So I'm going to leave it at that and say, get to know this wonderful Chicagoan by adoption in his case, by birth in the case of his wife, Shirley. I do want you to say something about why you picked the Sinatra that we're going to go out with.
Sinatra is my favorite male singer.
Okay.
And, you know, he's just classic. But I picked this one because one of our good friends and another favorite person is Quincy Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And this album is a classic. It was recorded at the Sands, the old Sands Hotel in Las Vegas.
Right.
And Quincy Jones was his debut conducting the Count Basie Orchestra. And so Quincy Jones, the Count Basie Orchestra, and Frank Sinatra.
It's as if it was done just for you.
It has to
and
be.
Me. It's right. My favorite, too.
Right.
We can't always admit that to people, though. Sometimes they get all. Walter Massey, thank you so much, and we would love to have you back to talk about some of the policy questions and issues that you offer so much insight on.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
It seems we stood and talked like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then. Can't remember where or when. The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. The smile you are smiling, you were smiling then. Can't remember where or when. Some things that happened for the first time seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we have met before, and then we laughed before, also loved before. But who knows where, when? Some things that happen for the first time seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we have met before, and then we laughed before, and then we loved before. But who knows? Who knows where? Oh, where?
We want to thank Walter E. Massey, M-A-S-S-E-Y. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for putting the program together with us and making it sound great, our funder, Alpha Wood Foundation, and other funders and friends of this program. Drop us a line anytime. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or visit WFMT's Facebook page on Facebook, WFMT. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can find this or any of our other programs on the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.